Hello to everybody joining us on Zoom, and hello to all those who are joining us via Facebook Live. My name is Keina Yoshida, and I'm a research officer at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security at the London School of Economics. And I'm also a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, where I have a practice hat on. This panel is a part of the Visions of Feminist Peace programme, and it's supported by the Arts and Humanities Research Council and forms part of a Feminist International Law of Peace and Security, which is a project led by Professor Christine Chinkin and Dr. Louise Arimatsu. The Visions of Feminist Peace programme is co-hosted with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILF, as it's commonly known. And I hope you've been able to attend some of our other fantastic panels so far. And if not, don't worry. I've been assured that they will be going up on the website shortly. And you can find that via the LSE Women, Peace and Security Centre's website. And if you go to current events and Visions of Feminist Peace, you will find it all there. We have three incredible speakers today who've been at the forefront of developing women's human rights. And they were at so many of the significant normative moments and continue to advocate for gender equality through their different mandates. And I feel really incredibly privileged to be chairing this panel. Before I introduce the speakers, first, I just have to say a few housekeeping issues. First, this is our last panel, but tomorrow we have another artistic contributions. Those who have been following the Visions programme will know that we have had music, a choir, spoken word, poetry. And tomorrow we have a musical performance by the amazing Amrit Kaur Lohia, a singer-songwriter, sarangi player and vocalist in the genres of Punjabi folk, R&B and soul. So plug in, it's going to be absolutely wonderful. And the other thing is just to say that you can ask questions to the panelists via the chat function on Zoom, and those of you who are on Facebook Live will know how to ask questions via that function, and I will be picking those up and asking the panelists questions. So this is a panel that explores the strategies and practices of feminist peace from the perspective of international mandate holders and institutions. It queries how such a vision might be secured, not least in the contemporary political climate and in light of the current global pandemic. There's going to be individual presentations from each of the speakers, then a short discussion, and followed by the Q&A. So I'm going to briefly introduce the speakers in the order that they're going to speak in. These are really brief bios because otherwise we would be here all day if I were to give their full biographies. The first speaker is Professor Yakin Ertürk. She is the Professor Emeritus of Sociology, and she has served as the Director of the UN Division on the Advancement of Women and the UN International Research and Training Institute for the Advancement of Women. She has held international and regional human rights monitoring mandates, including the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls, Its Causes and Consequences. Within this context, she undertook fact-finding missions to various countries. She received complaints on human rights violations and women's rights violations around the world, and she prepared thematic reports which are available to read online. She's the author of many publications, the most recent being Political Economy of Peace Processes and the Women, Peace and Security Agenda, Conflict Security, and which is published in Conflict Security and Development, which will be of interest to those of you who work in or who are studying women, peace and security. But she also has a wonderful book called Violence Without Borders, which I highly recommend. The second speaker is Jane Connors. Jane is the victims' rights advocate for the United Nations, a post at the Assistant Secretary General level to which she was appointed in August 2017. Immediately prior to this appointment, Jim was Amnesty International's Director of International Advocacy. And from 1996 to 2015, she held a number of posts in the UN, including as Chief of the Women's Rights Section in the Division for the Advancement of Women Department and of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs at the United Nations headquarters. Basically, that means that Yakin and Jane used to work together. And the chief of the Special Procedures Banks and the director of research and the Right to Development Division at the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Jane has also published and taught at many institutions, and she is the contributor to what some of us know as the CEDAW Bible, which is the CEDAW commentary. I will leave Jane's bio there. And the third speaker is Nala Haidir, and she is a member of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, and Commissioner of the International Commission of Jurists. Nala has over 30 years of professional experience, mainly within the United Nations system, ranging from social development to relief coordination to emergency management training and capacity building to development cooperation, to peace building and to human rights. And those of you who have been following the work of the CEDAW committee recently will also know the important role that Nala has played in relation to General Recommendation number 37, which was on climate change and disasters. So please welcome at home the speakers today. Give a little clap if you're at home. And I'm going to pass over to Yakin.
Oh, you're muted, Yakin. We can't hear you.
Sorry. Here we go. Can you hear me now? Yes, I was just saying greetings to everyone, to you and all those people whom I cannot see and wish that we were able to communicate with, interact with. Well, I'm very happy to be here nonetheless, despite the fact that we have to improvise. But thank you very much for the introduction to this session. Now, the international order, of course, has been very instrumental, as we all know, in all the gains that we have made so far. And I certainly take no personal credit in any of this. It has been an incredible struggle of the global women's movement for the past decades, engaging with the UN system, regional system, in bringing women's issues to the international level, where then we were able to use to correct things back home, which didn't always go so well. But anyway, my personal experience, of course, into this whole issue of gender equality, gender-just peace, rather, stems not only from academic interests, but my 6 years as UN Special Rapporteur, where I was able to visit conflict and post-conflict countries, but also observe how countries that were theoretically in peace were so war-prone in terms of women, because violence was so endemic. So this provided an incredible venue to observe that this war-peace dichotomy does not really reflect women's experiences. And I also had the pleasure of taking part in two commissions of inquiry, one on Kyrgyzstan and the other on Syria, to see how more mainstream instruments operate and how they differ or converge with the women's issue. So 1990s in general was a very dynamic period in giving legitimacy and visibility to gender issues. And the many instruments, which I'm not going to count, which everybody knows by now, have been milestone achievements, and of course the Security Council resolutions being among them. So I don't want to reflect on what we have gained today, because many of these are under incredible threat, and some under the corona pandemic, we realize some of these gains were somewhat illusionary. And we've been discussing these at different platforms. What I want to do is rather focus on what we haven't been able to gain, what were our failures, and why violence is still very pandemic, persisting, and we are far from achieving gender-just peace. Now, the whole issue of gender language has become very much widespread in the UN. Some call it feminizing the UN system or international organizations. But this should not fool us, because gender norms themselves, as opposed to the language, has been very slow in trickling down to the ground and to the work of the international organizations as well, for that matter. So we have been sort of colored with gender language, but not achieved much in terms of the norms, feminist norms, that lead to gender just peace and gender equality. And these have been very slow in trickling down and across, as I said. Now, despite 1325, now 20 years since its adoption, and all the research evidence that shows that women's participation has very positive impact on the quality of peace and durability peace, but despite all this, women continue to be excluded from peacekeeping missions, negotiations, post-conflict transformation, etc. So the resolutions themselves, although we celebrate their adoption, and Jane and I were very privileged to be in the room when we all very excitedly experienced the adoption of 1325 and welcomed the ones that followed. But the impact has been quite modest, if to say the least. And according to Secretary General's reports, we can see that there has even been a downward trend in the past 10 years in terms of integrating gender and women's issues into peace agreements and peace processes. So this is sort of the gloomy side of the picture. So this is why we cannot really talk about gender just peace at this moment. But I don't want to sound gloomy, because despite all these failings, I think we have to look at the international system as a platform for counter-hegemony. It provides us an opportunity to challenge the established hegemonic values and relationships. Basically, significance of the international system can be brought down to three factors. One, it is a system of rules which are agreed upon, negotiated among member states, that states are bound by. Now, this has been an important tool for us who have worked on various mandates. I, as a special rapporteur, gave me an opportunity to challenge states for not complying with their responsibilities. Although many states would say, well, we have other priorities, as we all know. But nonetheless, it is out there, and states are responsible. Secondly, it's a venue for articulating feminist demands. From the very beginning of multilateral diplomacy, women have brought their demands to the table and shaped treaties, institutions, etc. And thirdly, and this I think is far more important in terms of the struggle that goes on the ground, is that it's a tool for mobilizing women. And 1325 in particular, if it had no positive impact at all, it had been an incredible mobilizing force. Women around the world are mobilized for peace and security, this international system is potentially counter-hegemonic, and in introducing gender-just peace and ending wars or confining wars. Emergence of UN and regional gender equality regime has therefore been instrumental in taming patriarchy and capitalism to a lesser degree, perhaps, but in altering what we have been calling the mainstream. The mainstream, of course, essentially is ordered according to patriarchal, capitalist, and militarist norms. So women's engagement with the mainstream institutions, with the little gains that we have made, has been very threatening to the status quo. So there has been a buildup of backlash. They see where this is going. They, meaning the patriarchs, little patriarchs, big patriarchs. So I can dwell on three points here in terms of the backlash. One, the very success of the women's peace movements, gender equality movements, in using the international regime to tame patriarchy, has provoked backlash, and the rising right-wing populist governments and groups have perceived women and LGBT rights as a major threat to the status quo, patriarchal status quo, and to the Holy Family, for that matter. As we know, the Human Rights Council has been passing protection of the family resolution since 2014. So it's not something that out there, but it has been infiltrating into the international system itself. So in the process of these threats, the international system itself is coming under threat. Multilateralism is being questioned, and international treaties and institutions are being undermined. Just in the last few months, what we have been observing, attacks on abortion in the United States, Brazil, Europe, you name it, it has been widespread. LGBT rights, etc. The Istanbul Convention has been a major controversy in my country and in Poland. We have been confronted with government announcing that they have the intention of withdrawing. This is not only about Istanbul Convention in Turkey and Poland. This is about the legitimacy of multilateral institutions at large. Trump's attacks on WHO. I can name many, many more encroachments. These are serious setbacks to the gains that we have made and the international system that allowed us to make these gains. Second dimension of the backlash is the comeback of the security state. And this has been building up, of course, with the 9/11 being sort of the peak point when security, national security, began to override human rights commitments. States use state security to counter all demands for human rights, peace, and security. So securitization of peace processes has been a major setback in this regard and for human rights as well. This also has given more push to militarization, military spendings, which means less money available for human rights issues. Arms trade, again, an issue which is rarely discussed and put into peace agreements, because generally, conflict is not only about the fighting parties, but those who are sustaining the fighting and triggering conflicts elsewhere through arms trade, etc. And of course, militarism also has a significant impact on promoting masculinities and femininities that support the nationalists and religious narratives. So instead of acquiring gender equality norms, we are building up more militarist tensions. The third has to do with the internal inconsistencies of the international system itself. And there, believe me, as we all know, there are many, and I don't have the time to count all of them. But let me just talk about gender mainstreaming as a starter. Jane knows how I dislike gender mainstreaming, and it's not for no reason at all. This has been featured as the UN's gender architecture, which would lead to change. No doubt we have achieved much through gender mainstreaming, but has it been a friend or a foe to feminist goals is a question that we still have to ask. International women, the integration of women into the mainstream is basically integrating them into a system which is designed to subordinate them. So to what extent can we achieve our goals within this kind of a framework? Security Council resolution, I think, is a good example of the flows in gender mainstreaming. The positive impacts, of course, that it has created a new momentum for peace and security. It brought new actors into the debate, such as the security system, which had been totally out of the picture. It focused on women's diverse experiences in conflict, not only victimization, but their active roles as peacemakers or war makers for that matter. And also it has helped mobilize women, as I have also said. However, there are serious drawbacks with this mainstream instrument. Many have discussed the legitimacy of the Security Council itself for the goals that we are trying to achieve through this resolution. I won't get into that, but it has been basically silent on issues of arms trade and disarmament, militarization at large. These are core issues for the feminist peace movement. So they're not marginal issues at all. There has been an overemphasis on sexual violence, victimization through sexual violence, which totally underscored the feminist emphasis on the continua of violence and how different forms of violence at times of war and at times of peace are continual and intersectional. And the whole war-peace dichotomy, of course, Security Council resolution clearly demarcates these two. So how is gender just peace possible at a period like this when Corona is exacerbating all these problems that I have very briefly touched upon? Well, of course, nothing is a zero-sum game. Dialectics is always at work, and each new step creates a new contradiction, which some of which women's movements have made very good use of. So it's these new contradictions, whether in gender mainstreaming or Security Council resolutions or other imperfect modalities that we are working with, it's the new contradictions that emerge that carry the potential for change. And in that sense, I think 1325 has, by mobilizing women, making them forceful in their demands for peace and participation, has changed the negotiation landscape. Whether peacemakers like it or not, they have to reckon with this issue now. And in all the countries that I have been to, this has always come up, and governments had to respond to how they are dealing with their commitments in this regard. Of course, the countries that I took up in the article you referred to, four countries, two before 1325 and two after, I think illustrate the flows that I'm trying to show. There are factors out there which are so dynamic and strong that 1325 really needs to be redefined. So in this sense, our experience with 1325 has also exposed the need for a paradigm shift in peace and security. And in this paradigm shift, this can be the talk of a totally new conference, but I think there are 6 points that I want to just highlight and end my talk here. The new paradigm has to be very conscious of the war-peace dichotomy, which does not reflect women's reality of peace and security. Two, it has to be human-based security, meaning not only focusing on public security, the whole issue of demobilization of forces and so forth, but private sphere security. And almost, I have not come across any successful peace agreement that focuses on private security, taking precautions at the private. Even during the Corona pandemic, governments have taken all kinds of measures to counter the pandemic without taking any notice of how the isolation and everything going back to the household is creating a new environment that exacerbates violence against women. So this is always the missing link, I think. Third, link of violence against women and socioeconomic status, the care responsibilities that women, even as we have achieved so much in the public sector, Corona has shown us that when care activities have gone back to the household, they have meant more work for women. So care responsibilities have to be factored into peace and security issues where they are located in the public sector, not in the private. Women's leadership, again, an issue which can be discussed at length. And here, I just want to underline the fact that we talk too much about women's participation, meaningful participation. It's not getting women there to be symbolic figures, but enabling women's leadership so that feminist articulations can shape the new decisions. Extraterritorial responsibility, again, rarely pronounced. States cannot say they have achieved gender equality and human rights within their borders when they are engaged in corporate or arms deals that create havoc for women in other parts of the world. So this is absolutely central to gender just peace. And of course, multilateralism, which I don't need to say more because that has been sort of the highlight of my talk since the beginning. I shall end there, and I'm sorry if I have taken too much of your time.
Thank you so much, Akin, for such a rich and incredible presentation. I'm going to hand over now to Jane Connors. And so, Jane, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Akena. It's a pleasure for me to be part of the panel. I'm really pleased to participate with Yakin and Nala. We could tell you a lot about how we've worked together, and I look forward to the conversation that we'll have afterwards. I'd like to give very best wishes to the participants for taking their time. I'm hoping that they're safe and well during, I suppose, the weirdest time I've ever experienced. I'm absolutely delighted that the Centre for Women, Peace and Security is convening these visions panels. I think they will help us think about progress and gaps, as I say, in this very strange time. And I think this time puts the notion of a gender-just peace in sharp relief. It's a very interesting time also because we've got all of these anniversaries and we're trying to celebrate these anniversaries in a very unusual context. So we've had 75 years of the UN, 38 years of the CEDAW Committee, 25 years of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action, 20 years of Security Council 1325. And 10 days ago, I celebrated 3 years of the Victims' Rights Advocate. So obviously I'm a toddler in comparison. I was looking at one of the visions panels and I saw it reflecting on the meaning of feminist peace. And it noted, and this is more or less picking up on what Yakin has just said, that peace is generally conceived as the absence of war, the absence of conflict, or the absence of direct violence. The notion of peace rarely captures violence which is indirect or structural, and rarely captures the importance of positive issues such as harmonious relations among peoples, communities or states, and certainly harmonious relations amongst men, girls, women and boys. Critical components for me of a feminist peace are economic and social justice, gender equality, the rejection of all forms of sexual and gender-based violence against everybody, women, children, and men, acceptance of and respect for diversity, and an understanding of intersectional discrimination. A feminist or gender-just peace would require laws, institutions, and social norms and practices which promote equality for all and also their implementation. Now, I'm confident that all of us today have internalized the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, internalized the work of the committee, particularly its general recommendations, and I congratulate Nala again for hers, decisions on petitions and inquiries, and we know that de jure and de facto equality is required. This means that the underpinning of inequality and injustice must be dismantled, and intersecting systems of privilege, power, domination, exclusion, oppression, which have disadvantaged women, girls, and others, abandoned. And this is precisely the idea of my mandate, and that of the mandate of the people who help me on the ground, the four field victims' rights advocates. They work in the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, and South Sudan. Our roles is to operationalize the central pillar of the current Secretary General's new approach to preventing and responding to sexual exploitation and abuse by all United Nations personnel. So my area is, I suppose you could call it niche, but if you think of, peacekeeping, humanitarian work, development work, there you're looking at real structures where there are inequality. And the central pillar of the Secretary General's new approach is directing at putting the rights and dignity of victims first. So putting their rights, putting their dignity at the centre of both prevention and response. And it's interesting that we have a stress on rights, a stress on dignity, and very interesting also that the Secretary General himself created these roles. So these roles were not created through a multilateral process. These roles were created by him himself. Now we all know that United Nations work has contributed to peace, humanitarian support, and enjoyment of human rights in many countries. And the majority of our personnel, and there are many of our personnel of different sorts, work with integrity, compliant with the spirit of the Charter and rules and standards that govern us. But allegations, often substantiated, of sexual exploitation and abuse by our peacekeeping, humanitarian and development personnel continue to surface. It's very difficult to determine what the numbers are, but they certainly continue. One is too many, but there are more than one, I have to say. And you can look at the allegations. They're listed on the website of the United Nations. If you go into issues relating to sexual exploitation and abuse, you can see more or less in real time. I mean, the UN's got an odd idea of real time. Allegations about peacekeepers or peacekeeping contexts, humanitarian contexts, development contexts, and also with respect to those we work with, implementing partners who are not necessarily UN personnel. To our shame, of course, the victims are the women, children, and men we've pledged to support and assist. And we see that there are similar allegations implicating people working in charities and other organisations who deliver aid. And I suppose many of you will remember the scandal which surrounded Oxfam in early 2018. This is interesting, of course, because it shows the power imbalance. But for us, it's not only shameful, but often they implement our programmes on the ground. These wrongs are the very antithesis of a gender justice peace. They cause harm and suffering to victims. They often leave them with children. They have profound negative impacts on communities. They normalise behaviours, and the behaviours are reflective of what goes on in, I suppose, we could call real life. I don't know whether we call it real life. They suggest they are permissible, and their drivers, inequality, exclusion, poverty, and insecurity, inevitable and acceptable. They fracture trust amongst populations, and that means our work, the UN's work, is compromised and indeed frustrated. It can be used very easily. I know in the context of one state where I do have a field victims' rights advocate, there is a Human Rights Commission, which is essentially a commission of inquiry, and they were speaking to the authorities with regard to violence against women and children. And what did the authorities of the state say? Well, you can't talk really, because look what UN personnel do to our populations in the country. These wrongs, of course, entrench discrimination and unequal power relations in places where women, children, and others are already undervalued. And their low status reflected in legislation, harmful practices such as early marriage, child booking, which is a practice where you reserve a child, a bit like reserving a restaurant table, before or just after the birth of the child, and of course, impunity. In her excellent monograph, also Jasmine Kim Westendorf points out that they create an exploitation economy which persists well after our personnel leave. So there's a normalisation and there's an entrenchment. And they also compromise our staff's sincere efforts to shape a gender justice response. I mean, many of our staff are very, very directed towards creating a gender justice response. But if you're in a context where there's sexual exploitation and abuse by United Nations personnel, this is obviously going to be undermined. My mandate is about recognizing the drivers of sexual exploitation and abuse, not only where the wrongs occur, but in the attitudes and behavior of UN personnel. They may have beliefs, Yakin and Nala will know, they may have these beliefs and views which discriminate against women, people with disabilities, older or displaced persons, LGBTQI plus persons, others who may be marginalized, or they might even discriminate against the local community as a whole. The mandate requires privileging victims. And I realise language is an issue. I mean, gender is difficult enough. Nobody seems to remember what it actually means, and they use it as a sword and sometimes a shield. And I realise with regard to the work that I do that there's a big discussion with regard to survivor and victim. I like using the word victim because survivor to me tends to elide the perpetrator. So you focus on the responsibility of the person to, I suppose, have resilience, rise up and so on. The Secretary General states that what privileging of victims means is requiring restoration of our personal connection with them and empathy towards them, and also doing this in meaningful ways and giving visibility to those who've suffered. This is a radical shift to early approaches to dealing with sexual exploitation and abuse by our personnel. And there have been many, many earlier approaches. They prioritise the conduct and discipline of our personnel and the reputation of our organisations. Obviously, these are important, but in pursuing these approaches, the victim was elided to a certain extent. We started work 3 years ago and our functions were new, and you can't imagine how difficult it was to start our work. We had vague terms of reference. There's never been a victims' rights advocate before in the UN, and very limited resources. What I did at the beginning was focused on broad advocacy and supporting the field victims' rights advocates carve out their roles of the first contact for victims and the accompaniment for victims as they went through related processes. But then I changed my mind as to what I should be doing. After I visited in late 2017 the Central African Republic, and there I met victims, and I came to the understanding that my role was to give them visibility, a voice, agency and support, and help them gain assistance, accountability and livelihoods. I'm happy to expand on what I've been doing in the discussion section, but essentially, I mean, and I think one of the things that we really need to pay attention to is if we're working with victims, it's not a cookie cutter approach. Every victim requires an approach which deals with her, and they're generally her. I know there are male victims, but they don't come forward, or his needs. But I just wanted to touch on the issue of participation in the field, especially in peacekeeping. You all know that 1325 urges the equal participation of women in all sectors of peacekeeping operations, including the military, and this is reiterated everywhere. Every resolution that you can come across, which even touches upon women, peace and security, will talk about this participation. And you'll find it in the report establishing my mandate. And this suggests more women would help advance UN efforts to prevent and respond to sexual exploitation and abuse. And you'll also find that sort of notion in the Action for Peacekeeping Declaration, Action for Peace, rather, Declaration of 2019. So at the end of August, we had almost 82,000 personnel working in peacekeeping, troops, police, experts and staff officers. 5,300 were women. So as you can see, there's been enormous progress. Now, the issues that arise with regard to why we would need women in these roles are important for me. My view is that they should be equally represented in these roles, as that is what equality means and non-discrimination. And I'm sure that their contribution and their participation would contribute strongly to the elimination of sexual exploitation and abuse and the realization of a gender just peace. But that defeats the purpose of them being treated as equals with respect and absent sexual harassment or violence. And for me, these are the ingredients of a feminist peace. So I'll stop at that point, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. Thank you so much, Kena, for chairing and steering us through this happy period.
Thank you so much, Jane. I'm not going to, and I'm sure we're going to go back to, I'd love to know more about your mandate and sort of the ins and outs of what happens, and perhaps we can have a discussion with Yakin as well about the fact-finding missions and parts of the special rapporteur mandate as well. I'm now going to hand over to Nala Haidir. Nala, can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you, Kena. Hello, everybody. And thanks to LSE for organizing this. I just can't forget our last meeting on the 40th anniversary of the convention, where Professor Shinkin and I, under your also able moderation, reviewed those 4 decades of CEDAW and what it meant. I want to build really a lot on a lot of what Yakin said in terms of the context. We are in a context of backlash and regression, and she gave ingredients of it. Multilateralism is in a full crisis, not only on the resources side, but also on the raison d'être, on its profound raison d'être. And I come from personally a country, and I like very much what Yakin said about the dichotomy of war and peace. My country has been for 50 years or neither in war nor in peace, but always in somewhere between the two, with a lot of tension, and definitely impact on women was always greater. And let's not forget, for instance, the last thing that happened in Lebanon that shows me that when women are not part of the process of reconciliation, of peace building, these peace agreement or whatever they may be called will never be sustainable. I have witnessed also as a member of CEDAW the past 8 years that most of the agreements that were reached, whether in Bosnia or Afghanistan, only paid lip service to women presence. They were never really what we expect of their integration in the processes from day one. And they are like window dressing. So I would like to approach the issue of 1325 and the vision of feminist peace from that angle. Why is it that 20 years after this resolution and the many other relevant resolutions that are good as text, we don't have progress? We have even, as we said, some setbacks, not only in the field of women, peace and security, but in the field of gender in general. I think for women, peace, and security, the weakest point is that these are only advice to member states. There's nothing binding in those resolutions. There's no monitoring mechanism. There's nothing for implementation. It's wishful. It's a list of wishes that the Security Council, adopt for member state to pick and choose. And if you are politically correct, you'll always have a plan of 1325. But what is the effectiveness of the plan? How is it really implemented? How is it resourced? How is it monitored? There's very little information on that that shows us really the weakness is the lack of accountability and monitoring mechanism. From day one, when I joined CEDAW was already working on the gender recommendation number 30, which is a landmark for the committee, as in addition to many other gender recommendations. But this one in particular was able to show that if we were able to work in complementarity in the UN and not in silos, the way we always continue to work, and we would have integrated much more the work of the Security Council on Women, Peace and Security with the convention. This is the only binding, legal binding instrument that has been ratified, although with reservation for some countries, but by 189 member states. and it's the optional protocol by 114. So this is an obligation. This is the only way you can talk to country and call them for account when they have an obligation towards something. We know that the system of the human rights mechanism is shaking now also with the pandemic, but this is the only tool that we really should hold on to. When there was a presentation at the time from my colleague, who is now the SRSG for women violence against women in conflict, Mrs. Patton, to the Security Council back in 2013, it was the same time when the Security Council adopted the unanimously the resolution 2122. And we were very happy, but in that resolution also, we knew the Security Council itself acknowledged that there is a need for significant implementation shift. It's similar to what Yakin said about the necessity of paradigm shift, but there is also a necessity now to think about real significant implementation shift. We did not see this shift. It was acknowledged, but did not happen. We had the Secretary General commission a global study on the implementation, and it had 193 recommendations. Do we know how many of these were genuinely implemented? What difference they made around? So I really think unless we stop saying the Security Council is political, but the Security Council choose the subject, which is because you go to the third committee, the other go to the other committee, and the silos continue. We have to cut and create by force, and women are able to create this horizontal necessary interaction that the UN continues to resist. So we have a fantastic UN women, and then we have a fantastic UNICEF, and then we have a fantastic, I've been a UN staff for 33 years, so I'm talking from my heart because it's my home, and I feel bad. I worked in humanitarian affairs 15 years, and I saw how little we coordinate properly, how little we build on each other's agenda, how little this is really one of the things that I would like to highlight here, that we should be telling, this is a human rights issue, it has nothing to do with me. Everything is interrelated. Development and right, and we have now the SDGs that are telling us that development is rooted in human rights. We spent 20 years speaking about that and we didn't get there with the Millennium Development Goals. Now we are there. So what can we do about all this scenario of what can we address, how can we do better? We can do better if we continue to, at least at our level in CEDAW, we are doing it, we continue to do it, because we've always felt that the state party's obligations at all time during the conflict remains for us. For all population within their territory, whether they are under their effective control or not, and for population across territory that are affected. So the extraterritorial notion that we speak about, Yakin, is included in the GR30. We have also always tried to put pressure on countries in particular who come to us with a plan, and that the plan is not effective. I'm gonna cite examples like Iraq. After many years, they received a lot of funds to do a proper WPS. They have an excellent civil society, and yet there is no concrete impact on the ground. So we call them to account and we give them best practices. We share with them and we ask for exceptional reports sometimes. I was, for instance, the rapporteur for the exceptional report on Myanmar, which we obtained after 2 years, but we obtained it. And it was focusing on these issues. Now, doesn't mean that we are going to be able to render justice all the issues, but we are working in an incremental manner to make sure that state party under this binding instrument, and we are really very conscious of the importance of the WPS agenda, but we want to give it some teeth, some ability to pressure, to require progress and measure it. We have also, I don't know at which minute I started, Kena, but give me a signal when I'm close 2 minutes to the 15 minutes. As was said also by Jane earlier, the fact that all the provisions of the convention speak about the de jure and the de facto equality is really a strength for us to be applied also in, on women and peace and security agenda. For us, there is much more to be said about countries that are not in covert war. They are in overt. It's not declared, but it's there. And we see the tensions, and we see how this crystallizes around gender issues. So we can do some more on prevention, on the preventive side, if we can work more closely also with the political and peacekeeping people. It's not just, you know, it has to be completely compartmentalized. I think also that, for instance, we had Syria, DRC, Sri Lanka, India, Colombia. I'm citing just a few examples of the country where we have worked with them on the Women, Peace and Security agenda. And we have seen, because I attended two dialogues, for instance, every 4 years with some of them, and we have seen the little progress achieved because they consider that they don't have to report to us on these issues. This is a political security council issue. So we have to do something really to make this significant implementation shift better understood and to work more horizontal system to be able to acquire more concrete results for the peace agenda, feminist peace agenda, because I really believe that I don't have one bright example of peace accord in the past decade or so, or two decades, where genuine women participation has made a concrete difference. When we meet Afghanistan more than once in my 8 years with SIDAO, and we hear the women from the podium saying, we were there like window dressing. So they know that they were being used because it is politically correct to have few women in the delegation, but they were not really integrated in those processes. I think our really big strength is our relationship to civil society, is all the shadow report that we receive, is the work done by the women activists, women human rights defenders, and their access to the committee with proper information, so that during our, in the reporting period, during the dialogue, in the follow-up procedure that we have, we can always use this information to push the country to commit seriously to this agenda. And I will stop here. I think I've used my 15 minutes. Kena?
Thank you so much, Nella. That was wonderful. And just to add, of course, that General Recommendation 35 also of the CEDAW Committee includes important norms and developments on extraterritorial responsibilities as well, which is it's a very worthwhile reading that whole GR. I want to start by asking some questions and to sort of facilitate a discussion amongst you all, although I'm sure it sounds like some of these discussions go back a number of years. For example, gender mainstreaming and whether it is a friend or a foe. What I wanted to pick up on first, however, is to ask a question about the mandates and the day-to-day of these mandates. And Jane, you mentioned meeting the victims in the Central African Republic. And Yakin and Nala, both of you mentioned commissions of inquiry. So I wanted to start the discussion just by saying, what is the importance of these types of fact-finding missions and meeting the women on the ground?
Maybe I should go first, because I really don't engage in fact-finding missions. My role is essentially the advocate for the victims, and why I mean, obviously, you may find them in headquarters context, but more likely because we're looking at the power differential. It's not, the mandate doesn't pick up on sexual harassment, which is it's very difficult to draw the, I mean, this is a typical UN thing. You draw a silo, you have sexual harassment goes one route and sexual exploitation and abuse. But I am dealing with those who've been abused by our personnel who are not UN staff members, typically, but they might be. But the objective, and I think it's very interesting because I didn't really have any direction. I'm the first, so I'm directing myself, so to speak. Why I go to the field, and of course I cannot now because of all of these restrictions, is to see what is being done with regard to prevention and response. And I hold myself out as willing to meet with anybody who wishes to meet with me, anybody who's been harmed by our personnel, in private and in whatever format they wish. And that idea is to find out what their major concerns are. And I can tell you what their major concerns are. If they have children born of sexual exploitation and abuse, they are their major concern. And a second concern, and I think this more or less reflects what goes on at the national level, is that they often don't have any idea what the process is. If they've complained about what has happened to them or someone has complained on their behalf, they will be interviewed and then they'll hear nothing for a long period of time or ever at all. So that's why, and it's not fact-finding, it's to look at the individuals and the issues that they have, to inform myself as to broader policy approaches, but to deal with the specific needs of those individuals. And one example is I went to Haiti, I think in 2018, and I met a large group of women with their children, both individually and in a group. And when they were in a group, what did they say to me? We've met people like you before. You come, you go, nothing happens. And their issue was that their kids couldn't go to school. They all had children born of minister peacekeepers who could have been police or military. And so I said to them, well, I can't promise everything, but I will do what I can. And I did find a small amount of money to send their children to school, which is, you know, it's not that I'm so marvellous, but that made such a difference to them. And that's what I do. So I think the fact finding that Yakin and Nala are engaged in or engage in is very different from the sort of work that I'm involved in.
Thank you.
Maybe I can come in here. I don't do any fact finding as such. I think it's only Yakin who can speak to that. But what I do in addressing women human rights defenders, because I am the reprisal rapporteur for CEDAW, I deal with cases of reprisal. And so I deal with women human rights defenders who have been harassed back home because they have provided information to the committee. Or sometimes in one country who have been in jail, one of them for more than 2 years now, just because she communicated with the committees and provided information for the review of her country. So these are instances really where, for me, it is crucially important to understand that CEDAW's work would be meaningless if it doesn't give a strength to women human rights defenders everywhere, that they should. It's unfortunate that we don't have a mandate on all issues of human rights defenders as CEDAW, because there is a special rapporteur for human rights defenders in general. But it's only linked to those who provide information to the committee, either oral or in writing. And this in itself reveals a lot of the stress that women are under, women activists can be under in their respective country. And we have several cases, and since we have had this function agreed upon in the committee, which is 2 years ago only, we adopted the San Jose guidelines and we started to work on aspect of our relationship with human rights defenders.
Well, since I'm the only one who does fact-finding missions, I better talk a little bit about the value of fact-finding. Well, first of all, fact-finding helps to document human rights violations, whether in normal rapporteur, violence against women rapporteur country visits, or commissions of inquiry. I mean, Syria, for example, I served on the first 6 months and we were not allowed entry into the country. But the documentation of the violations that we were able to do from those who were in the camps in the surrounding countries provided incredible amount of information as to what was going on in the country. And of course, at one point, when the conflict subsides, this kind of information can be important input into the judiciary process. So documentation is absolutely essential under different conditions. It also, from the perspective of the mandate holders, I benefited tremendously because we talk about the universality of violence against women. This is just words that you cannot substantiate unless you experience violence under very different conditions. Or it can lead to isolating certain cultures or geographies as a problem and others being free of violence. So I think for me, the fact-finding missions, and I did missions to developed and underdeveloped countries, gave me an incredible understanding how patriarchy operates in very different ways at different levels. So this also feeds into improving the methods of the mandate and also into our theoretical understandings. As you know, the special rapporteurs not only fact-finding missions, but they also write thematic reports. And all my thematic reports have benefited tremendously from my observations on the ground, and I was able to talk about the due diligence obligation of the states, define it as a non-legally legal expert person. I try to demystify the concept, the approach of culture as the reason for violence or whatever. So one of my reports was on that, which then created an incredible interest from the civil society at large, and campaigns started. There was one campaign called "This Is Not My Culture," in Asia, and many others. And of course, my final report, "Political Economy of Violence Against Women," linked the two covenants, if I may say, and the notion that violence is only about harm done. So it really enriches our understanding. It also gives political visibility to problems in a country. And here I'd like to talk about the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. When I went there, I was shocked at the level of violence and impunity, despite the fact that many things have happened in this country in terms of trying to rebuild the country after the conflict. And after my mission, with the support of some civil society international organizations, we lobbied countries, delegations, about the importance of focusing on the DRC case, because at that time, Darfur was sort of in the forefront and everybody had sort of forgotten about DRC. And the two, you cannot compare disasters, but I certainly felt that the political depolitization of DRC was a major problem. So fact-finding missions also bring these back. And perhaps there are many, many reasons I can count for fact-finding, but perhaps one of the most important contributions of fact-finding missions is to empower people on the ground, because rapporteurs have two parallel meetings with civil society and with government. Of course, the one with government is always a very strenuous one. They trying to hide facts from you, you trying to capture facts. But the real insight come from civil society meetings, and the women or other human rights defenders, survivors, etc., whom the rapporteur speaks with, becomes empowered and encouraged to share their experiences. So it's there are, of course, drawbacks too. For example, my mission in Iran, I had one sort of a group meeting with people in one of the provinces. One young man got up very rightfully, said, "You're going to leave tomorrow and write a fancy report. What's going to happen to us?" So fact-finding missions also can have drawbacks for the people on the ground. So we need to be very mindful of making sure that we don't make things worse for people while we're trying to find facts.
Thank you so much, Yakin. And just sticking with the example of the DRC, we have quite a few questions on DRC coming in. And Jen, I think they're mainly to you. So the first question is with regard to the UN mapping report on crimes committed in the DRC. Does your advocacy work include victims that were part of that report? Do you deal with victims of international crimes? So that's the first question.
My mandate is very specific. I'm very familiar with that report, because I'm very familiar with what happened in the political body where it was, but we won't go into that. It's important that people understand that my mandate isn't about victims writ large. It is to do with the victims of ourselves. And I often say that it would be much easier for me if I had a mandate to deal with victims of armed conflict, victims of whatever, because as you can imagine, for example, if you're thinking of a university, if you had a victims' rights advocate to deal with harassment of students by their professors, by their teachers, there would be a lot of pushback, and you could imagine that. So my role is specifically to address those who have been harmed by our personnel, and that's broad. Not only peacekeepers, most people think about those who create harm as being the guys with the blue helmets in the tanks and so on. But no, we find that also people in humanitarian contexts where they say there's no war necessarily, but there's not necessarily peace, and development contexts do also engage in sexual exploitation and abuse. Sexual exploitation is typically transactional sex. This is prohibited for UN personnel because of, well, for many reasons, but because it's inherently, you will be dealing with inherently unequal power relations and the likelihood, we're talking about people who are in extremely vulnerable situations. Sexual abuse will be sexual activity with a person under the age of 18, defined for us as a child, or unwanted sexual activity with a person who is an adult, of all sorts, an attempted activity of that nature. So it's very important that when people think about my role, they think about what it means. It's because the UN is an employer. It's essentially, it doesn't have any judicial, apart from the employment process, administrative process. It doesn't have any further criminal or civil capacity. But my focus is niche in a way, but it's very important because when you think of peace, security, and I suppose if you contemplate issues such as patriarchy, this lies in institutions such as my own, the military, and religious bodies, for example. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jen. And I think there's been a couple of other questions that mainly relate to the same question about accountability and international crimes, and whether how you ensure accountability, I think. But my understanding is that is your role, is to ensure accountability within the UN. Is that right?
Well, accountability in terms of criminal or civil accountability for persons who perpetrate these wrongs will lie in the state of jurisdiction. And that is very, very complicated indeed. With regard to the accountability, and I'm involved in that as well, pushing in particular for the realisation of paternity child support claims and for the realisation of any criminal accountability that may be possible. But that lies in the state of jurisdiction, and that requires some, if you're looking at the criminal part, that requires a lot of consideration of issues such as is the act a crime in the state of jurisdiction? Is there a capacity for extraterritorial jurisdiction? So accountability has many meanings, I believe. And I always get into trouble by saying these sorts of things. When you speak to people, they don't immediately talk about how they want their case to be before the ICC. They talk about what concerns them at that particular moment in time. That does not rule out for them accountability of criminal nature, and certainly doesn't rule out for them the paternity child support claims. And they may be satisfied to learn that their perpetrator has been sacked, for example, but they may at the same time be a little ambivalent because they may rely on that perpetrator for support in some way. So this all feeds into what is a feminist piece. I mean, how are we going to approach these things? And I know there's a big debate about people who are engaged in sex work and whether they have, you know, how they should have agency with regard to UN personnel and so on and so forth. But I'm not quite seeing the agency myself. But there you go.
Thank you, Jen. Yakin, I have two questions for you. And Nala, I have a question for you. And I think that's probably what we'll have time for. Yakin, two nice, easy questions for you. How can institutions like the UN challenge patriarchal narratives on the ground and within institutions themselves? You mentioned that patriarchy works on differently on different levels. Where do you begin? So that's the first question. It's sort of two questions together. And the second question is about the fact that picking up on Jane, what Jane talked about in terms of we are really at the moment of lots of different anniversaries, and there's been a number of important declarations and normative developments on women's rights. We have a gender empowerment intersectionality, but can there also be an appropriation of feminist language without commitment to the feminist cause and subvert the meaning of their terms? So sort of a co-option of women's rights, the dark virtues, as Ratna Kapoor would say. And how do we go about this and make the UN a counter-hegemonic force? So those are your two questions.
Wow. Thank you for those easy questions. Well, I think this is the crest of feminist scholarship and women's struggles for years. How do we make the UN and international system feminist and challenge patriarchy? This is not an easy thing. And where do we start with patriarchy? First of all, I think where do we start is to sort of demystify all the binary concepts, categories we have in our minds. The north-south divide, east-west divide being the most popular. And really challenge these kinds of approaches to explaining where a woman's status. Just to give you an example, when I did a mission to the Netherlands, the two gentlemen who were responsible for the woman's machinery said to me, well, Dutch women have completed their emancipation. The problem now is with the immigrant community. Violence against women exists only in the immigrant community. Well, clearly, this sees patriarchy as something belonging out there. And this kind of a narrative is very deep, not only in state approaches, but civil society sometimes also falls into this. And UN is not definitely free of this bias. I think we have to challenge it at all levels. And how did we do this in our past experiences? How did we achieve the gains that we have? Well, I think women who have been within the UN have been very instrumental, you know, feminists working within the UN, working with women outside to push the boundaries of the UN. But this is a very difficult task, especially given all the drawbacks that I talked about. It's going to be more and more difficult. How can we make civil society participation within the UN more meaningful is a question that has been always on the agenda, not only UN, but all multilateral institutions. How can we make CSW more responsive and participatory? So challenging patriarchy using the UN system has to deal with all these levels. And also, let's not forget that UN is about states. It's not, yes, there is the UN bureaucracy where the day-to-day work gets done, and an incredible amount of work gets done there. And many of it is in collaboration with feminist scholarship and women's movement in trying to reveal patriarchies at different levels. But UN is intergovernmental, and the decisions, the treaties, etc., take place at the negotiating table among states. And we know that there are, depending upon the time period, different dynamics are at work, and very contradictory elements get into treaties. Now, this doesn't mean that we give up on them. To the contrary, I think we're happy to have them, and the issue is to push the boundaries further. For example, the concept of patriarchy. If I'm not mistaken, the only document, formal document, that uses, refers to the word, doesn't talk about patriarchy, but refers to the word, is CEDAW General Recommendation 35. You don't see it in the Istanbul Convention, you don't see it in the CEDAW framework, you don't see it in, it's not a concept that is light, I must say. People do not feel comfortable with it. But the very fact that the way we have used the UN system, civil society, as well as the various entities within the UN, has made it a counter-hegemonic platform. So it's a matter of using that more effectively, I think. Just linking it with the question previously, the fact-finding missions. The fact-finding missions also, if used effectively by the rapporteurs, can feed into a standard setting. And this is where I think the link between what goes on the ground and how standards at the UN level become generated can feed on one another. So it's a process, it's a struggle, which is not easy. And the second, just linking it to the second question that you said, yes, appropriation. Yes, I think when I said the gender language has been flourishing to the level that some people have talked about the fact that UN has become feminized is so misleading, because UN language has been appropriated to a large extent. And gender mainstreaming, I think, is one of the slippery grounds where the real norms, the real gender goals become sidetracked by using all this gender rhetoric. So we need to be vigilant. We need a new vision. I think we're at a point in multilateralism, feminism, gender just peace, where really paradigm shifts are absolutely necessary given what we have learned so far. So we need to change the rule of the game, if I may say. We need to change the mainstream dynamics itself, not integrate into the mainstream. So far, I think that has been our agenda as feminists, to integrate into the mainstream, but that's where co-optation, unfortunately, takes us astray. So from now on, we must be working towards, while trying to integrate into the mainstream, because that has its merits, but to change the rule of the games as we enter, whether from inside or outside. So it's an ongoing struggle, I must say.
Thank you so much, Yakin. And the last question is for Nala. Nala, if you can, I don't know if you can hear and see me.
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Yes. The question is, can you please tell us more about the work that CEDAW has done in areas that are seen to have been largely overlooked by the WPS agenda? For example, climate change and disaster reduction.
Yes, thank you very much, Gaina. I just wanted here to add to the point made by Yakin that the alliance between feminists inside the organization and outside the organization is key to put things back on track and achieve this paradigm shift. And as someone who has been inside the organization for 3 decades and has now somehow outside the organization, I can attest to the importance of the dynamic, especially civil society. But I will add also another player that we did not explore enough in the past, and that could be a good ally. And these are the national human rights institutions, which are, have a status A, that are really performing their task in a country, and they are closer to the civil society in country, that they can bring some alliance with them to also achieve the desired change. And the issue of patriarchy, as Yakin also said, we always raise it under Article 5. We always refer to stereotypes and the issue of patriarchy. But it's true that in the convention itself, when it was written, this was not a notion that was developed. And we came back to it, thank God, with the GR 35 updating GR 19. But now coming back to your question about the other GR that could have been really very useful, also if we were to open a dialogue with DPA, political affairs, or with people who works on women, peace and security, DPKO, we had a very good also general recommendation on refugee, asylum seekers and statelessness. And this is a key issue. I mean, initially CEDAW wanted to deal all of it in one GR. And it found that it's impossible to address it. So we had the conflict, post-conflict and peace building on the one hand, then we had the one on refugee and asylum seeking and statelessness. And then we had the natural, initially the disaster risk reduction should have been also in the same, but then we started to understand much more the impact of climate change on what the so-called natural disasters. And we went that route, and it was my chance to lead that process. And I see really that aside from those who are really engaged in climate change issues, I see very, very little, unfortunately, use of the GR and very little domestication of the GR. And I think one of the key strength of GR 30 is that it managed with the funding from UN Women to have a guide for the implementation of the GR. That made a big difference. We are trying now to see if someone is interested in helping to also help domesticate GR 37, to take it more to the grassroots level, to put it in different languages, because sometimes these tools, they become dusty in drawers and they are never used. They don't have the impact they should have. Although we have tried in that GR 37 to make it really action oriented with very specific recommendations that are doable. And now I think the last GR that we are working on will be of interest again to the Women, Peace and Security Agenda. And we thank LSE for having hosted a meeting for a preparatory meeting for us. And that is the one on trafficking in women and girls in the context of global migration. Again, there is no war and peace scenario. There are all the tension around this situation of massive influx of refugees or displacement and the abuses that occurs that women suffer in that context. And the next GR, when we adopt this one, which hopefully will be in the session online at the end of October, we will have the one on indigenous women. Again there, Yakin spoke about extraterritoriality. Most issues of corporate responsibility happen in land of indigenous people who are pushed out of their land and who nobody is accountable for the damage caused, or and they are displaced forcibly from one place to the other. So I think if I just list the GR that I have witnessed developing from 30 onwards, this is when I landed with the committee, I think they are crucially important, and it's going to be 38 of them next October. What can we do together to vulgarize the content, to bring it to the grassroots level, to bring it to influence policies? I think I leave the question with you. You know, the committee doesn't have resources of its own, and it's frustrating to see a lot of work going into these issues and not being able to impact in the field, I mean, to impact on the ground with the people who need this information, who need this for their policy development.
Thank you so much, Nala. We have 5 minutes left, and I'm going to use my chair's privilege to ask the last question. Yakin, you mentioned that we need a new vision. So I was wondering if each of you wanted to perhaps share where we might find that new vision. As you know, as a part of the Visions program, we have been asking musicians, poets, choirs, other people to provide some cultural inspiration with respect to feminist peace. So I was wondering if you had someone, a poet or a musician, a song or a writer or a piece of work that you turn to when you think about feminist peace. Jane, can I start with you? Is that is that okay?
Yes, it's something that's really a difficult question, but I can tell you that the most inspiring thing that I was engaged in recently was a survivors town hall, which was organized by the CEO of an organization called RISE, and people can look it up, RISE US, which in fact showed to me that the new vision is to, well, it's not necessarily a new vision, but it requires greater attention. Really hear from those affected. Our vision, it's you know, our vision can be, you know, sort of literary and so on, but hear from those who have been affected, and then in fact organize your way forward according to what information they provide you with.
Thank you. Yakin?
Well, how can I say anything after what Jane has said? I think that's where the inspiration comes from. And our vision has to be built from bottom up, I think. That's where the diversity in women's experiences can enrich our understanding of where we're going to go and how we're going to rebuild. Because I think there's such an incredible need to revitalize the global women's movement, but this has to be sort of pushed from the real experiences of those on the ground, and especially those who whom we are so concerned about, the survivors of all these tragedies. It's very empowering to see how people can endure such suffering and go on. I think that's very inspirational. And the last few years, the whole issue of art for justice has become a major tool in expressing the concrete experience of people on the ground. I think we need to exploit that further in as a tool of expression.
Thank you.
My turn now. Sorry.
Yes, okay. No.
I think that instead of a vision, I would like to speak about my dream. My dream is to see that in my region, Palestinian and Israeli women are the leader of the peace process in that region. I think the day I will see that, I will start trusting that we are going to reach a sustainable peace, because they are the one who have endured most, and they are the one who can really build a just and lasting peace in the region. And if it comes to artistic expression, I was telling you before we started the important projects that are now going on in Lebanon, art therapy for children from the trauma after the blast. And you can see fantastic things getting out of the of this expression of anxiety, anger, and all of it, because in particular the blast itself, because it was a self-inflicted tragedy for Lebanon. It's not like we can accuse somebody did it to us. It's irresponsibility, corruption, etc., etc. So this is the worst thing that you can, you know, justify to a victim in a so-called war context. So I leave you with these two thoughts. One is my dream, and the other one is the art therapy for the children in the region. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and sorry for that difficult question at the end, but they were all incredible answers. It just leaves for me to thank you all for your presentations and your participation. to thank the audience for their questions and for being virtually with us today, and to close the event. So goodbye and take care, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.